threads of art, culture, and history. David Swatling creates an oral tapestry.
I'd seen Measure for Measure twice and never had the energy to attempt to follow the plot. It was, you know, just a lot of people. But then I was working in Germany, and I can speak German, but I can't really listen to it very well. Unless they're actually talking to me, then I'll know what they're saying. But I went to see Measure for Measure, or Mass for Mass, and I could follow it. I mean, not particularly what they're saying, but I suppose because in the German translation, the actors actually knew what they were saying.
Ken Campbell has 1,000 theatre stories, and we'll sample his one-man showmanship a little later. But we begin with another actor who specializes in solo performances. Frank Shepherd arrived in Amsterdam in 1986 via the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, where he'd been performing with a San Francisco-based company. He decided to stay in Holland and has worked here extensively ever since. Last year, he was approached by visual artist and musician Mike Tyler to work on a piece called Holoman, Digital Cadaver, based on real-life murderer J.P. Jernigan, who received the death penalty in Texas in 1993, but not before donating his body to science, in particular, the Visible Human Project. According to Shepherd, the corpse was frozen, sliced into thousands of paper-thin sections, photographed and digitally reassembled into a cyber cadaver for anatomy students.
Okay, but when you meet Holoman, he's already in that state. This was the fun, because when you play this sort of monster, this sort of non-human thing, it was fun be able to be that free, to be something without volume, to try to get in touch with those sort of non-real things. Holoman is a person who is trapped in a hologram beam. He is your modern technical corpse. The actual thing of being able to just go on and on, the whole of you, the parts of you, forever, and to be able to be transmitted into many different parts of wherever in the world at the same time. And your arm could be there in Paris, and your legs could be in Texas, and things of that nature. So it was a lot of fun. The idea of playing a hologram in this sense was like watching or doing something that I had watched on television with the Voyager, Star Trek Voyager, which they have this hologram doctor, and beam me this way, beam me that way. I'm not real. What do I experience? Emotions and whatever. But my story in dealing with Holoman is that he calls forth people and situations in which he goes back and forth in dealing with the fact of being poor, the development of his life. Yes, he committed these crimes and these things. And yes, they come back to haunt him if he questions the fact, well, what if I just allowed myself to die and without going through these experiments and things like that? I would not be experiencing the memory of the 75-year-old man that I killed. You question who really does it benefit in the end, or maybe this project benefited or is benefiting students and people who are doing research into the human body and anatomies and things of that nature, or what happens with who makes the money. There's a question that the guy asked when he's been offered the deal, am I patented? And the guy said, oh, no, you're more than that. You become a registered trademark. Yeah. And so you then question the thing about who else could for many years, who else are available to do these experiments on that sometimes benefit humankind? And usually it always is someone who's in prison that is approached to take a chance on some new drug or to take a chance on some other thing. And what happens to their soul, if they do have a soul? And then if you now have embedded it into this data bank, it's running loose out there, and in the influence that it has on people. And as people look at this thing, and they forget that this was a person or a thing that murdered, and look how he's now benefiting to go on forever.
Frank Shepherd's latest project began with an idea conceived by Amsterdam's Cosmic Theatre director, John Leerdam, who, inspired by Robert Wilson's one-man Hamlet, was interested in trying a one-man Othello. But that wasn't enough for Shepherd. He convinced the director to add originality and complexity by juxtaposing Shakespeare's tragic Moor with the former American football pro O.J. Simpson. The result?
O.J. Othello, because after the trial, where there are a lot of people who were equating, I know I did, O.J.'s story with the Othello story. In some regard, just there are some parallels of two men rising to the top of whatever they were doing, and then trying to assimilate this lifestyle, and would having to have some insecurities because they did not fully fit the bill in this new level on which they had arisen to, and so. The murder or the death of the women in both of these men's lives had such an impact, well, on what the people were around them. I mean, in Othello's story that was written by Shakespeare, that was one thing in it. But O.J. had this complete rise, and he was respected, and he was honorable, and he was accepted in the most sense that. He and many around him felt that he was colorless. And rising to this height and then being dropped to such an extent and then being acquitted. So John felt, okay, we'll try this O.J. Othello. And he got a guy who's a writer, not only a writer, he's a rapper and he's a director, and his name was Martin Van Hinton. So he's okay. Let's put this together. We did some collaboration and talking with Martin about myself as an American and an athlete, and these things that were involved in that sort of thing that O.J. probably went through in his early life. This O.J. Simpson guy was a kid. I mean, who could have gone either way. I mean, growing up in an environment where he came from, I know, in San Francisco, just on the border, just on the edge of the great, beautiful city, San Francisco, and then being influenced after getting exposure in junior college, after meeting celebrities and things like that, and people were going for his skills, this talent he had as an athlete, and got bombarded and zapped into this huge media world at a very young age.
As opposed to playing a fictional or a dead real character, playing someone who's still living, does that play on your mind at all when you're performing this?
I mean, no, because I've actually had the opportunity years ago to play a person who was sitting in the audience. So, well, I didn't go and take into account of trying to look like O.J. or whatever, just from the material that was written. I just tried to take those words to heart because they're so heartfelt, what Martin has written. Wasn't even in my mind, so that became as a surprise to me when people would come up and say, "Hey, I saw O.J. there on stage when you were doing him and things like that. And then that happened really from the beginning. It was amazing because there were some people, Americans, who had came over and just by chance came to see the show. And there were relatives of O.J., distant relatives. One had just found out that he was a relative of O.J. because he was invited to a family reunion. And they felt that the mark was hit. And probably because the words that Martin has put down there for me to say, it pretty much rings into people, like, of what they felt or what they have seen O.J. to be. And then for the information that I'm giving is new to them. But the tone that has been set, I guess, make people believe, oh, wow, this is O.J., you know, this is it, you know, this is it. Which is strange in a way because some people do come out, I find, with a different opinion about the whole thing.
In a kind of full circle, Shepherd will be taking O.J. Othello to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this summer. Having tried it out on Dutch audiences, he's looking forward to its further development in front of British audiences because he feels that the evolution of a theatre performance is an ongoing process.
When you're doing original things for the part, or you're trying to add those elements in which you stay fresh and the thing is constantly changing, you're constantly looking for new things in it so you don't stay flat. When you're working, you can make all kind of choices in the direction that you want to go. And it's just looking at another side, another angle, because you go with the commitment to say, okay, let's play it this way, and let's take this tone, or let's take this speed. And that is the fun. And that's the musicality behind it, because in music you find that I can listen to an artist do this one song, and they have like four or five different versions of that song. When you look at great people like Sarah Vaughan, who never sang the song the same way twice, and then you're looking at the blues aspect, you go, well, how many different versions have I heard of Rock Me Baby? Yeah. So in that sense, that embodies me, the music aspect, and in that, when I'm performing things like that, I want that to be possible.
British actor-storyteller Ken Campbell would certainly agree. In his wildly funny and sometimes anarchistic performances, anything seems possible. The more unlikely, the better. He began performing in the 1960s and became well-known in alternative circuits for his famous ferret down his trousers routine. His latest show, which he recently performed in Holland, is simply called Theatre Stories, and the source of all his material is his own life, and what a life he conjures up. But then again, he's been telling stories for a very long time.
Even before I had anybody to tell them to, because I was an only child, and I used to tell stories. It was in the war, you see. I was born in the war, and during a lull in the Blitz or something, my mum and dad would say, when I was sent into the toilet, oh, yeah, my parents used to say, go in there and perform. That was like going into the toilet, going to the washroom, bathroom, whatever you want to call it, yeah? Go in there and perform. And so I used to literally perform in there. I used to sit on the toilet, and I used to perform for the little creatures and animals that I fancied I could see in the linoleum. You know, they had it was basically an abstract linoleum patterning. But I could divine the animals and the jungle there. Very particularly, there was a frog, and it was this frog, I think, which used to draw from me these considerable narratives. I think I'd act all the parts. Well, I wouldn't act all the parts, because I had an imaginary partner that used to help me. Yeah, we used to Bomb Riders of Africa was one of the great tales. Christmas with the Pygmies.
A boy's own kind of.
Yeah, it was very, very high adventure. And I tell you, there was something really strange. I remember when Cannibals were going to put myself and Peter, that was my invisible partner in these great wartime toilet dramas. We were going to get... we'd been mistaken for missionaries or something, and cannibals were going to put us in a pot and cook us. But then I showed them how if you put the cylinders from the middle of toilet rolls in your eyes, it looked, you know, kind of wacky. And they were so impressed with this that instead of cooking us, me and Peter became king of the tribe, joint kings of the tribe. Well, then, many, many years later, when I did go out to the South Pacific, you know, what had been Cannibal Islands, one of the most dominant art forms are these kind of humanish figures with toilet roll cylinders in their eyes. I mean, it really is a going thing. Now, I don't know where I could have picked up that from. That's just one of the great wonders, isn't it?
Well, you know, a lot of the details in your stories seem to be, there's these odd coincidences or synchronicity. Is truth stranger than fiction in that way? Those don't seem to be the kinds of things you can make up.
I think it is. I mean, there's a kind of wisdom that I'm not sure is a wisdom, where regular putters on of plays on television and in the theatre, you know, and it's like you're telling them, you say, listen, this thing happened. Listen to this. This would make a play, wouldn't it? And they'll hear it. And they say, well, it's a fantastic story, but it won't make a play, no, because an audience wouldn't believe it. Do you know what I mean? I've always thought that's some kind of rot, all that. And so in any shows of any sort that I have to do with, I always like there to be a lot of those kind of things in. To me, they really are believable, you know.
In theatre stories, you go back to sort of the 60s and the 70s of your theatre career. Is theatre so much different now than it was then?
Sadly, it is, yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I battle this. Is it just I've got old, you know? And I've become one of those old people who remember how good it used to be, you know? It's a hell of a battle. But what's happened is people are so reliant on being funded. It's sort of like become... one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not do a show lest thou hast funding. Do you know what I mean? Well, I mean, if you've got a bunch of people who've got something remarkable, you can just do it. Yes? I mean, my daughter now has put on the world's longest play, 23 hours long, with a zero budget, company of 40, and no money's been spent on it. Well, money has been spent on it because the cast have had to spend their own money on bus fares getting there and all that, do you know what I mean? And time's been spent and going around skips and rubbish dumps getting a set. but the result is, the result's really frantically exciting.
Now, this is a rather important production. I mean, it's in the Guinness Book of Records, this play, isn't it?
It's in the Guinness Book of Records, yes. This is the play called The Warp. Yeah, it's in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's longest play. I don't know whether it is now, but it was when we did it. So it's in the 1982 Guinness Book of Records edition for sure. And it's a hell of a piece, actually. I'll tell you what it's like. At the same time as Dickens, there was another fella called Henry Mayhew. Right, two books I know of his, Mayhew's London and Mayhew's Underworld. And what Mayhew used to do was follow lunatics, tramps, prostitutes, all these things. He'd follow them home, and he would interview them in depth about how they lived and whatnot and all the trivia of their lives. Brilliant work. Mayhew's London, Mayhew's Underworld. And The Warp is a similar thing, but a more present day. The author, Neil Oram, virtually had done that. I mean, his quest was for kind of truth. He was a kind of seeker. But he kind of assumed that a lot of truth would be found amongst tramps and in the garbage, amongst washer-uppers, you know, like mad washer-uppers at Olympia and all that. And so it's an incredible piece. It's like the wildest of documents, The Warp is, because it's all severely so. It's an autobiographical play. You know, and it certainly must have the longest male lead ever. I don't know, was it 5.5 times the length of Hamlet, I would think. I mean, this guy's Because this guy's playing Neil Oram, the author. Actually, it's called Phil Masters in the play, that's who it is. And so, I mean, for Neil to have known all these things, he had to have been there. So that guy's going to be in every scene. In fact, well, he's not in three scenes, but they're very short ones. Anyway, the guy who played the lead 20 years ago, Russell Denton, he learned all those lines in about 3 weeks. Last year we had a shot at doing it. I was a young actor. Because once Russell Denton didn't want to do it anymore, he didn't want to do it anymore because he'd come to know more about Neil Oram than he knew about himself, and it kind of freaked him. He'd get nostalgia for events in his life that hadn't happened. They'd happened to Neil, and then he decided to devote the rest of his life to himself. He became a gardener. But last year there was a young actor who wanted to have a shot at it. He was kind of a classy actor, and he assumed he'd be able to assimilate it. And we gave him 10 weeks rehearsal, but he was unable to assimilate it. He assimilated a lot, you know, but not at all. And anyway, there was a kind of an attempt to see what it looked like, but the answer was it looked like looked rather good for half of its length, and then hopeless for the other half was the answer to that. And then
and half of 23 hours is a lot.
Oh, yeah, no, what is? Well, no, he was really slow. It went on about 29 hours. That's another thing. Actors are much slower now. Anyway, that was that. We gave that up. But then my daughter learnt it. She'd been my assistant director on it. She was only 17 or 18. She decided to see, was it possible to learn this? And she wanted to learn it in the same time frame that the original guy had, i.e. 3 weeks. So she did nothing except learn it. And she learnt it in 2.5 weeks by doing nothing else, utterly. And we put on a little private production of the piece to see her through it. It was really good, actually. I enjoyed that one enormously. But she had no intention of acting being a career. She just simply wanted to do it as a personal challenge. But then a guy's now cropped up later that year, and he said, yeah, I'll learn it. And he did, and he's learnt it utterly, thoroughly. I mean, it's magnificent. He's just absolutely terrific. In fact, he knows the whole play. We don't have to have a prompter, because he knows everything. He'll, if anyone forgets their lines, he'll tell them what they are. And I start the show at 8 o'clock in the evening on a Saturday, and then it'll finish at around about 7 o'clock in the evening on the Sunday. But it's not really the effect isn't really like that of a play. I mean, there's no seats there. You have to wander around. It's kind of like being in a pirate village, to be honest. And so once you've seen it, in memory, it's not like having been at a play. It's about having been at a place. Do you know what I mean? It's more like remembering some kind of strange holiday. And there's always, for everyone, an hour or two of great difficulty of staying with it as you're really going through the bit where you should be in deep sleep, like going through that. Well, those bits seem to go into the memory much harder than the regular bits. Yes, it's strange. There's a lot of the audience come back and back. It's a kind of love generator as well. Mm-hmm. There's, amongst the audience and cast and everything, there's all kinds of romantic partnerships seem to develop over these magic 23 hours. Mm.
One thing that was really fascinating in your show, and I kept, throughout the thing, as you were doing it, I kept thinking, is this real or is this not? It seems too fantastic to be true, and yet it seems absolutely true. Yeah. And this was this language that you translated Shakespeare into at the end, this kind of world language.
Yeah.
This was true then?
Yeah, utterly. Oh, yes, no, the language is true. It's the language of the South Pacific. Well, literally, it's the language of Papua New Guinea, where they call it Tokpisin. It's the language of the Solomon Islands. I think they call it Solomon Islands pidgin there, more probably. And in Vanuatu, which is the name now for the New Hebrides Islands. They call it Bislama. But it's basically the same language and thought of as one phenomena. It's called Wolwantok. Wol meaning world, wan meaning one, and tok meaning language. Wolwantok. Because for them it is really, it has united their world with this lingua franca. Because every tribe's got a different language out there, you know, let alone every island. And so they've now got a kind of unification with language. At least anyway, they can talk to each other in this primitive fashion. And it's a language which doesn't take anyone more than a couple of days to learn because it's just so simple. In fact, I mean, now that I've got into it, I notice strange things in articles written by people about the wonder of grammar. Philosophers have been kind of writing this way. Grammar, it's grammar that has given us all this wonder. Well, it's grammar that has probably, it seems to me, to have, on which the is like the bomb which hit Babel. You know what I mean? When Babel Tower crumbled, I mean, it's probably because of different arguments about grammar, because all you need to be able to, for the world to be able to talk to itself, is for everyone to sit down, or not sit down, lark around best, play around for a couple of days and learn about 200 words. And then you're off. That's all you need if you don't want to have grammar. Because what takes the time learning a language is tenses. But the South Pacific Wolwantok language has got no tenses. If it's in the past, you bug in the word bin. That's it. But, and they don't, nobody as much cares where you put it in the sentence. You haven't got to learn all that even. You know, like German, got to have the verb at the end. I mean, verbs are, I mean, they're not very fussed about what's a verb and what's a noun anyway. Just simply communicating, do you see? So if it's in the past, you bang in the word bin. And if it's in the future, you bang in the word by and by. Yeah, so that's it. And if it's now, you don't do anything, because obviously it is. Yeah, or you could say now, if you were very fussed. So that's it, that's the tenses done. Well, that's, if you were learning German, that's 50 or 60 pages of a first primer sorted out. Subjunctives, they reckon that subjunctives have never brought anyone any happiness. They haven't got any subjunctives. And imperatives, right? Imperatives. Well, you want somebody to do something, an imperative. What's the imperative form? Will you shout it? If to ask a question, you make the statement with a look on your face, like you'd like the other one to say something now, comment back or something.
Kind of interviewing technique almost.
Yes, that's right. No verb to be, because that's a bastard when you're learning a language. Everyone's got, you know, really irregular forms of the verb to be. Well, they couldn't work out what it meant anyway, so they haven't got one. Like, I am here. I thought I knew what that meant when I started looking at it. I am here. What does the am mean? You know what I mean? I mean, if you start inquiring about it, it turns out you've got to take a lengthy philosophy course to get close to any concept of what I am means. I am here. They just say, me here. Me here. And that kind of does it, doesn't it? So, I'm going to hold Wolwantok parties, I think. You know, so this is one of my ideas to get it spread as a world language, is if you make it so much fun and such a craze, you know, your Wolwantok weekend, I mean, anyone would be a fool to have missed out on this, then that would kind of creep along. And also, I've got to go to a meeting next week because some business people reckon that if it is as easy as I say, that in fact the world could be taught it without ever being told it was being taught it. Do you know what I mean? It would just kind of infiltrate in through, I don't know, Teletubbies puppets or something like that, done in Wolwantok, you know, Sesame Streeted in and through ads or whatnot, maybe, if it'll happen. Anyway, I don't know if that's a good idea, but I'll go to a meeting about it. And because this is my idea, you see, that why don't we all just grab it and have it as a world language? That's my mission for the millennium, is to that the world shall have this is its world language by noon, January the 1st, 2000.
Storyteller extraordinaire Ken Campbell. Will Wolwantok render the English service of Radio Netherlands obsolete? Technician Ruud van Steenis looks skeptical. See, I can't even speak English. Stay tuned for further reports. Till next time, I'm David Swatling saying thanks for listening.